Welcome to Reboot Your Brain. We've gathered the world's leading experts in brain health, neuroprogramming, and thought management to teach you how to help your brain help you. They are sharing strategies to transform your health, your business, your relationships, and your life. Remember, only a relaxed mind can learn, so get comfortable, take a deep breath, grab a notepad, and listen in to today's guest, joining your host, Leah Lunt, your brain makeover coach.
Hi, and welcome to Reboot Your Brain Summit. I am Amanda Helena from Soul Strategies, and I have the pleasure today of turning the tables on Leah Lund, who has been interviewing all of the experts that she has collected together for this amazing summit. And I get to turn the tables and interview her today. So Leah Lund is the brain makeover coach, teaching people all over the world how to use neuronutrition and neuroscience to grow emotional resilience, mental agility, and the peak brain performance needed to succeed in every area of their life. Leah has amassed so much experience. She's a neuronutrient therapist, health leadership and personal success coach, laughter yoga teacher, author and speaker, and mentor for the Neuronutrient Therapy Institute. And she has been the founder of One Whole Health and has created the Reboot Your Brain Summit to help educate and inform us all about how we can optimize our brains and our minds. So, Leah, welcome. It's so wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much, Mandy. I really appreciate you stepping into the role and surprising everyone today with a new host, right?
It's great. I will do my best to fill your shoes, Leah, as the host of this interview. So let's kick off. You talk a lot about eating to feel good or feeding your brain. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If there were one thing I hope people in this listening into this event really walk away with and understand about themselves is that how you feel and how your mood is and how alert you are and how focused, and even whether you crave things or not, it really comes back to all of those are functions of our neurotransmitters. And I'll probably use neurotransmitter and brain chemical interchangeably, but these are things like serotonin and endorphin and some others. And they really, how you feel is not your mind can certainly have an influence because your perspective has an influence, but there's this physical component kind of lying underneath that a lot of people don't know about, that no amount of positive thinking would completely compensate for, let's say, enough serotonin flowing readily when you need it in your brain to feel good and to feel happy and to feel optimistic. So there's a direct correlation between these chemicals and how you feel and what you can accomplish in your life.
It's so true. And we know from personal experience just how important it is that we address those underlying, you know, neurotransmitter deficiencies. So Lee, can you tell us, like, someone knows food affects how they feel, you know, and then they make a decision to eat a certain way, and what happens with that?
Sure. Well, so, you know, there's always a popular way of eating, right? You know, whether it's Whole 30 or paleo, or, you know, different trends kind of come in and come and go. A lot of them are really positive because they're whole food based diets, which I would certainly recommend, and have good vegetables and fruits and good amounts of protein, good fats, and all those things. And so I think there's a lot of knowledge and education out there in general that people more or less know what to eat, and especially what to eat for their brain. However, a lot of times somebody will start to eat in that new plan, and I always hesitate to use the word diet. I never mean that as a calorie restriction, but if you considered it an eating plan or a diet, they'll start that new program, try to eat the things they know they should eat, try to stay away from the things that they know have no nutritional value. And they'll find that their craving just overtakes them. They might be successful for the short term, and that's pure willpower, right? Of I'm just not going to do it. And I always say that pure willpower is really the number one form of self-sabotage, because eventually we're all human, and eventually there's going to be, you know, the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the weakness is there. Except it's not a weakness in the person. And again, I can't stress that enough. It's a biochemical imbalance, or depletion is a better word, that's driving that craving. And so it really makes it almost impossible to stay away from things, especially like sugar and white flour products, things that are real addictive, cheese, even alcohol, red wines, all alcohol, really. It makes it almost impossible to stay away from them just by deciding it with your mind, because your body and your brain are literally sending you a physical craving all the time to have those things.
Yeah, and to, you know, like I love what you say about that around willpower being, you know, the greatest form of self-sabotage, because we cannot make long-lasting change when we're merely relying on willpower. We'll always, Kate, I know that from my own personal experience. There was always, I could last so long, but then I was always going to cave. And so it sounds like the answer is that addressing the neurotransmitter deficiencies or depletions, as you say. So
yeah, and it's, you know, you might look around, somebody listening might look around and say, oh, well, I know a few people that I think have, you know, this tremendous willpower and they're so disciplined. I bet they're not always. And I just want to say that, because what popped in my head as you were talking is someone I know who doesn't eat any fat, not understanding that that's not what would make you gain weight. Doesn't have a weight problem in any way, shape, or form to begin with anyway, but just very super rigid about how they eat. And literally, she will sometimes hide in her pantry, in her kitchen, and eat M&Ms in the pantry and hide, you know. So for anybody thinking that there's some super-powered level of willpower out there, probably not. The people who really eat in a balanced, healthy way, probably have really good brain chemistry going on, would be my guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great, because you mentioned, you know, that there's a way that we can feed our brain and to produce the neurotransmitters and have that balanced brain chemistry to help us feel good and to have that natural sense of willpower. Can you walk us through an example of how that works?
Sure. So I guess I'll use, again, there are four different main chemicals that contribute, or categories of chemicals that contribute to how we feel and whether we have cravings or not. And so if I use the example of serotonin, if mm-hmm. somebody is depleted in serotonin, they will absolutely have sugar and starch cravings. And the body is miraculous, I think, because it will get what it needs any way it can get it, even if it's, you know, even if our mind takes that and makes it a not very smart choice or helpful choice, the brain will send a message. And so if somebody's low in serotonin, they're definitely going to have sugar and sweet cravings. And there's a reason for that, and it has to do with the order that amino acids cross the blood-brain barrier. The main ingredient, if you will, in making serotonin is an amino acid called tryptophan. And so if you eat it, something that, and tryptophan is, we think of it, we call it the runt of the litter. So it's the last one to pass over the blood-brain barrier if all the other amino acids are present. So it kind of gets lost in the race, unless you eat a sweet or starch, which causes you to produce some insulin, which wipes the blood clean of all the other aminos, and tryptophan kind of, you know, I picture the little huddle or the football move, like it gets through there and makes it across the blood-brain barrier, and you do get a lift of serotonin. So mm-hmm. So you're depleted in a chemical. It's not your imagination. Your body sends out a message, get me some sweets or some starch, because I know that will help us make serotonin. And you eat that sweet thing, and then you produce a little serotonin, and it feels good. Feels good for the short term. Unfortunately, it's not very long lasting. And it also, at the same time, those foods erode the brain's ability to make all of the chemicals for the long term. But in the moment, it's not your imagination. It really does work and feel good.
Yeah, and it's a physical reason behind all of this. Like, I love how you always say we do everything for a good reason or a reason. There's always a reason why we do the things that we do. And I can hear that explanation behind that, that actually it's not just our imagination. There's a physiological reason why this is happening.
Right. And sometimes it's a biochemical reason. Sometimes it's a subconscious thinking reason, a protection, a safety. We've shifted from our reasoning prefrontal cortex, maybe, you know, into other parts of our brain that are about fight or flight and protection, you know, but there is a reason. So if you find that you're doing something, you intellectually say, why do I do that? I know that's not good for me. I know I don't want to do it. You know, I know it causes stress in my relationship, or I know it causes my body to look and feel a way that I don't want. You intellectually will know it's not the best idea, but there's some part of your being, physical or the subconscious, that it's serving a purpose of some kind.
Mm. And how does this affect women in particular?
Well, women, so all of these chemicals, women are at, we make less of them than men to begin with. So for an example, again, serotonin, we make a third less just by our design. So we start out at a little bit of a disadvantage.
That doesn't seem fair.
Yeah. We have other chemicals that help us in other ways and help us do, you know, the role of being mothers and that kind of thing. But our serotonin can be at a deficit much more easily than men. And the same is true to some degree with all of these chemicals. And so, first of all, I really want women to know that so that they are not comparing themselves maybe to their husband or, you know, male friends, because you're going to be more prone to having the deficiency that causes the craving, or having the deficiency that causes maybe the anxiety, or having the deficiency that causes you to be a little irritable now and then. and it's, you know, not that we're unstable as people, as a sex, but we definitely have that disadvantage neurochemically. That can actually be really difficult in relationships, because if women are emotional, if they're sensitive, they get their feelings hurt really easily, or they get angry really quickly, or they get irritable about things. Men don't understand it. You know, it causes a lot of tension in a relationship because they've never experienced that. Perhaps not, you know, that's a generalized statement, obviously, but, you know, they're more likely to have not experienced it than a woman is. So, you know, they look at us like, what happened here? And why are you so upset? And it's no big deal, and just get over it. And we've got all this biochemical, we're not even getting into hormones, you know, I added on top of that, like sex hormones, but we have this depletions or this struggle to make these chemicals that, you know, cause us to feel that way.
Yeah, and that sense of just not getting us as to why are you reacting this way, and can cause even then more stress. So how likely is it someone listening that they are experiencing a neurotransmitter deficiency or depletion, and how would they know, Leah?
Yes, so in the case of serotonin, the research estimates about 80% of people in the U.S., and I'm sure that's not that different other places, although the further above the equator you are, it's more likely because of sunlight, or at least at certain times of year, because we need serotonin is the only neurotransmitter that, in addition to certain nutrients that it needs to build the serotonin, like our little tryptophan, it also needs light. So the less daylight, and that's why low serotonin cravings are usually later in the day, afternoon and evening, because if the sun goes down and the cravings go up, that's a sign that it's serotonin. So different areas of the world can definitely have little differences, but if we use the U.S. as a representative, 80% of people experience a deficiency. And
wow.
I've mentioned some of the ways you'd know, but there are, in total, when I assess a new client, we assess how they're feeling, to use a general term, and how their mood is in a list of 40 different symptoms. So There's all kinds of things that tie back to your neurotransmitter. In the case of serotonin, as an example, it is irritability and anxiety and anger and even rage. It is those afternoon evening cravings that I mentioned, but also some physical things that you might never think of, like headaches or TMJ or fibromyalgia, gut issues. A lot of times when people have gut issues, it's because they're not making enough serotonin. Serotonin is made, 90% of it is actually made in the gut, which we know now is a brain in and of itself. There's neurons, there's head brain and gut brain and even heart brain and probably other brains we'll discover soon. So when the gut is off, there's a neurotransmitter role in that as well. And that's just serotonin, and I've talked a lot about that one so far because I think most people are somewhat familiar or have heard of it or know what it is. But then there's other chemicals like our group of what we call catecholamine, which include things like dopamine and norepinephrine and epinephrine. These are our get-up-and-go chemicals. They keep us motivated. They keep us focused. They flow. Dopamine especially flows when you set a goal and you achieve it, or you try to learn something new and you achieve it. So it helps you, and it releases even further when you're making an advancement, I guess I could call, of some kind, you know, learning a new language, traveling somewhere and having to figure out where you are. It's a very stimulating kind of pleasure chemical. And so if you are not motivated, if you are having a depression, but maybe it's less of a sad depression, because a sad depression would be more low serotonin related. A low catecholamine depression is really flat, really blah, apathetic. You know, just, should I do something new? Should I meet a new friend? I don't know. It just sounds like too much work. Yeah. You know, I'm not excited, not excited to do it. Even ADD, diagnosed ADD, is a matter of not having enough of these chemicals, not having enough of a reserve, or not having enough of them being produced. And then there's two others, and I'll just quickly, GABA is our stress. It's how we handle stress. So it really completes the feedback loop. When we get stressed and we start to make adrenaline, GABA comes along and lowers that adrenaline back and brings you back to neutral. And if you don't have it, then you stay in a stress state all the time, and you keep making you keep making cortisol, and you perceive everything as an emergency, or, you know, very serious or very stressful. So GABA, if you're especially if little things that didn't used to stress you out, you find that they stress you out now, that's a good indication that you're depleted in your GABA. And then endorphin, real quick, is our pleasure chemical and our pain relief chemical. So it's, I call it the hippie neurotransmitter, because it's kind of peace and love and everything's good. I feel no pain. and because of that, if it's depleted, it's a major reason why people seek out substances and other ways to feel peace and love and no pain. And in particular, if somebody craves cheese or gluten, chocolate, red wine, these work with the same area of the brain that endorphin would, which is the opiate area. So certainly opiate drugs as well. But you know, that's, you can tell a lot about your brain chemistry from what you're actually craving. Because if you're looking for stimulation, it might be more caffeine. But if you're looking for that peace, love, and it's usually not caffeine. It's usually something else. And it might be cheese and red wine. And I always know I can spot endorphin, and I kind of see the world in terms of these four categories now everywhere I go and everybody I meet. But if somebody uses the word love, I love my chocolate. You know, I love my cheese, or I love my red wine. It just is right there. It's like love is not really.
It's so obvious.
Yeah.
So, like, why haven't we heard of this before, Leah? Like, you've covered off so many symptoms and so many behaviors that so many of us have struggled with. Like, why is this not being more widely known?
Well, and a good example of that is in putting together this summit, you know, that this neuronutrition, or another term that's often used, is amino acid therapy. You know, there's probably a handful of us that talk about it. And, you know, so that gives you an indication right there. When you're talking about your brain, there's a lot of people talking about neural programming, and there's a lot of people talking about more of the medical approach to psychiatry or things like that. But there, and more and more talking about nutrition, and I'm really happy to hear that. I think probably every speaker we've had has mentioned how important nutrition is for the brain. So that's really good. But not many people are talking about this. And I have to, you know, part is education. And as you mentioned, I'm a mentor with the training program at the Neuronutrient Therapy Institute with Julia Ross, and we're working on it as fast and furious as we can get people, you know, interested. Mm-hmm. So that's part is, you know, a lack of education and training. It is not covered in a medical doctor program, a naturopathic program. Most, you know, so it's just not part of the training. But I have to also say that probably a big reason for that is that there's not, so the solution that we haven't really talked about is you start to feed the brain these nutrients, and you do it in concentrated forms for a period of time, for not forever, but for a period of time. And that means supplements of amino acids. Supplements aren't patented. There's no money, there's no marketing, there's no big machine behind supplements because you can't patent them, and there is behind pharmaceuticals. So I think that honestly, this information gets kind of squashed and put in the background because the pharmaceutical industry for anxiety, depression, sleep, I didn't mention sleep disorders. This is extremely helpful for insomnia. The diet industry, you know, is huge. So I think there's some money issues that keep this sort of on the back burner.
That would make a lot of sense. And we touched on, you touched very briefly on how this works. So do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more and why the amino acid therapy is so successful?
Absolutely. I would love to. So if you assess and if you decide and realize that you are depleted in some or even all of these chemicals, and it's very common, most common, that if you're depleted in one, you're depleted in the others, mm-hmm. because all the same things kind of help your brain make them or get in the way. So it's very likely most people are depleted in most of them. The approach that I take is starting out initially, so there's kind of a process over a period of weeks, and initially it's really all about getting the brain the highest concentrations of the right nutrients, vitamins, minerals, and amino acids as quickly as possible. And I can't stress in a high enough concentration. So it's not mm-hmm. about, oh, I know now that I need protein and protein has amino acids in it. You could start eating a lot of protein, and that's actually a great thing to do, especially protein for breakfast. But you will probably feel better right away, but you probably won't be able to absorb. There just aren't enough nutrients in there for your brain to start making enough serotonin all the time. And how it works with these chemicals is that they release some in the moment when you make it, and so you feel good over the, you know, course of a few hours, but also the excess of molecules are stored. So you literally have a reserve that you can draw on when something happens that you need more. So I think of it as, you know, four gas tanks in our brain, and there's a serotonin tank and an endorphin tank, and you want to provide the brain enough nutrients that it can fill that reserve back up, because then you don't dip below that level. You know, you stay pretty even keel, as opposed to something stressful coming along and your level is low and you just have nothing to work with. So in the first part of working with somebody, I would suggest specific vitamins, specific nutrients, specific amino acids. They would be taking a fair amount of supplements for a period of time, maybe 5 or 6 months. It's not forever, maybe even four, you know, for some people, depending if there's been a major tragedy, injury, loss. It could even take a year, or addiction issues. but somewhere in that time frame. It's not forever because it's very reparative. So the brain does absorb all these nutrients, start to make that chemical, start to build up the reserve, and then eventually you do get to a point where you don't need the supplements anymore. But then I shift into looking at other things too. So after the supplement piece is in place for people, then and only then do we start to make dietary shifts for the reason that we've talked about. If you could do it now, you would have already done it, right? You know sugar's not good. There's probably not a person listening to this that thinks sugar is a health food or gives their body a lot of nutrients. But it with the cravings caused by these deficiencies, it's just impossible to stay away from it. And it's so addictive too. So only after the supplement plan is in place do we start to address, well, what are the best things to eat to maintain this? What are the best things not to eat because they literally sabotage the brain's ability to make these chemicals? And then for me, when I'm working with somebody, if there's anything left unturned, you know, if there's any symptom, let's say insomnia, I have people rate things on a scale of 1 to 10, how extreme they feel it. Maybe they're just not sleeping at all. Every night they have trouble. They rate that at a 10. If in a case, it's very possible amino acids alone could resolve that problem because you'd get your serotonin boosted and therefore your melatonin boosted. And it's very possible that would be more than enough. And then maybe you would make dietary adjustments that eliminate stimulating foods late at night. And that helps. But for some people, that won't cover everything and they'll still have some sleep issues. Maybe it's gone from a 10 to a 5, but it's still a 5. They're still, you know, a few nights a week not getting the right sleep. Then I help people delve into, is there something else going on like adrenal function, cortisol, you know, sex hormones, thyroid? There's probably 24 different things that I pretty regularly help people look at for each of, again, those 40 different symptoms. So for a lot of different feelings and situations that they encounter.
Yeah, and I have having worked with you myself, Leah, and gone through your amazing program, I can speak so confidently of how thorough you are around looking at all those possible impacts. So thank you so much for sharing it because I think this is such a critical part of our healing that isn't discussed enough, and so it's great that you're out there leading the way and sharing it. We are coming near to our time with you today, Leah. So as we close off, I wanted to get you to talk about, well, what's your gift for listeners? Because you also, other than gifting us with this amazing summit that you've brought together, you also have another gift.
I do. And it is that actual brain chemistry assessment that I mentioned. So I want to invite listeners, if they have heard what I've said here today, they've heard this come up maybe with a few of the other speakers, and you're curious and you wonder, well, does that apply to me? You can, on the website here at Reboot Your Brain, we'll have a link up for the assessment, or you can go straight to onewholehealth.com. And it's on the first page there as well. But you can literally go through and assess. And it's self-scoring. So you'll know as you're doing it because the higher the number, the greater the depletion. So if you're a 10 in things, that's a definite reason that you want to investigate neuronutrition programs. I say if it's not a 3-2-1-0, like it still might be a concern, you know, and we get in the habit of sort of tolerating things because we think there's nothing to be that can be done about it. So let's say you're a sensitive person, a sensitive woman out there that cries sometimes and doesn't know why. And, you know, their husband doesn't understand that at all because you just turn into tears at moments. A lot of people think that one, by the way, is a sex hormone, you know, or hormone issues. Sometimes it is, but it's often endorphin. So, for example, if that was a 4, low endorphin, I should specify. So if that was a 4 on a scale of 1 to 10, is that a way to live? To me, no. Why have, you know, cry when it's appropriate? I'm not talking about numbing emotions, you know, as, say, antidepressants would, where you just sometimes are completely numb and don't have emotions. I'm not talking about that. When something is sad, our tears are good. This is part of our healing and coping process. But when you're tearing up and you don't know why, and it might happen in job situations, or if your boss is angry about something, or at a school parent meeting where people are debating and holler, you know, arguing with each other or something like that, you know, that is that's influenced by the low endorphin. So my suggestion and hope for everybody is, even if it's a 4 on a 1 to 10 scale, where a 10 would be, you know, crying every day, probably a 4 isn't good enough in my book. And Mandy knows that, because I say, well, what else can we do? Let's get it.
Yeah. That's it. And that for me was revolutionary, to go, you know what? It's absolutely acceptable to have, like, be scoring all those symptoms, like a 0 or 1, or like, I think the highest number I'll get these days is maybe a 2, and that's it. And it's like, wow, I never knew I could feel so good. And I think that's what you hope for your clients as well, is to know that the well-being that is possible for us, absolutely, is extraordinary when we heal these neurotransmitter depletions. So.
Thank you so much. That's I appreciate you commenting on your experience with the program too, because you're just such a great example of the potential, and even how it helps you step into the world in your business and in change you want to see happen, and in being spiritually connected and leading others. Last comment is, I'll say, these are all these little symptoms we talked about. I think of them as just nuisances, right? They're just like little mosquitoes or bugs flying around us that get in our way and kind of cloud our vision and distract us from giving our gifts to the world and living our purpose, and we can get rid of them. So
yeah. and you're supporting people to do that so graciously, Leah. What you provide is a wonderful gift, and I really encourage anyone who's listening who thinks they might be impacted by neurotransmitter deficiency, go on to onewholehealth.com, do the assessment, have a look at that, and then know that it's absolutely your birthright to feel great in your body and in your life, and that those symptoms can be rated really low. So, Leah, thank you so much for coming, for letting me turn the tables on you today and interviewing you. It was a great pleasure. And, yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. And for everybody listening, thank you. And we'll see you next time on Reboot Your Brain.